So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, a new BBC Studios boss is finally chosen. Spoiler, it's the same as the old one, but now it's official. Our panel look at why it's taken the BBC so long to sort. Over in Europe, the radio industry has been getting together to look at the fortunes of broadcasters during the pandemic. Is confidence returning to the audio sector? All that, plus the rise and rise of Substack. Has Channel 4 neglected its hard-of-hearing audiences? And in the media quiz, we see who's dropped onto the casting couch. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. And joining me today, it's an all-star lineup. We welcome back the editor of Newsweek International, Alex Hudson. Alex, since last year on the show, you've had something of an anniversary to commemorate. 10 years since the Hackney riots?
Yeah, 10 years since I didn't die. So I was out reporting. I'm not allowed to say for the BBC because it wasn't for the BBC. It was just on my own back. Very clear legal definition there. I was out reporting and I got het up in a bit of a confrontation, and my life ended up being saved by the Hackney heroine who shot to viral fame for a video recorded 20 minutes before she saved me, but I ended up being pushed into a burning car and having to flee through a block of flats. It was fun in retrospect, you know, interesting journalism, but terrifying at the time.
Is that your most dramatic media story?
in a sort of life and death way, yes.
Good. Also back on the show is Karen Robinson, planning director at communications firm Edelman. In case I don't expect that you've been near any burning buildings recently.
Fortunately not, although I am quarantined in my home because my daughter has COVID, so that's our personal drama at the moment.
It's one of those things. It's the curse of all parents, isn't it? In and out of school issues. Somebody else who's having issues this week is WPP. What's been going on in their accounts department?
So they've just been levied a gigantic whopping fine by the SEC in the US, I believe, for failing to prevent bribery happening across their global business. I'm happy to say I do not work for WPP anymore. And from my experience when I did work at WPP, I can only say that I find this news disappointing, but not shocking.
So WPP are a kind of conglomerate of lots and lots of operations, aren't they? And they're all across the world. So some of their subsidiaries have been greasing the wheels to get some deals done.
Yeah, fundamentally. I mean, WPP is basically a holding company that consolidates together a huge number of agencies, advertising, creative, PR agencies around the world. And so there's obviously brilliant and amazing people who work across the business, and businesses doing fantastic creative and strategic work across the business. But there's a real commercial drive that happens that gets pushed down from a parent level at WPP, which, you know, I personally have always felt undermines a lot of the good work that is happening. And then, you know, obviously that leads to results which are less than ideal, creatively and strategically, but also ethically some of the time, unfortunately.
And alongside them both, we have the doyen of all things Channel 4, the media matriarch. It's media writer Maggie Brown. When I sort of have taken over from Ollie in the interim here, and he said that, you know, since your book's come out, that's it, we've run out of things to talk to you about. Is what else is going on in your life? Where have you been? What have you been doing post-release?
Well, actually, one of the good things is that it's very timely. I was very upset because of COVID, the book was delayed virtually for a year. And so I was getting very sort of upset about that. But in fact, fortuitously for me, the whole Channel 4 privatisation debate started up all over again. So it's obviously a specialist book, but it's been in demand. And I've been doing quite a few of these, discussions via Zoom or whatever. The Oxford Media Convention, a university that trains a lot of people for jobs in TV production, and another conference about, you know, public service broadcasting. So I've actually found myself quite in demand in these kind of specialist circles. And I'm afraid trying not to be too much of a know-all, and flinching when people get quite a bit wrong about Channel 4, when I think they probably ought to know a bit more than they do, but trying to be polite to people and understanding that I am a bit of a sort of, you know, didactic on this subject. But no, it's been a good experience, and it's now just about to be published in America.
So the newest volume is Channel 4, A History from Big Brother to the Great British Bake Off, which I've read and is great. And I guess like all big media companies, lots of chopping and changing at Channel 4 over people, which brings us on to our first story. So after months of rumour and off-the-record briefings, we have a new head of BBC Studios. That's the BBC's production arm. And Alex, this has taken, 13 months to sort out? Who's got it and what's been the hold-up?
So the man who's got it is called Tom Fussell. He's been there since, he's been in charge since September 2020, so it's been over a year. And the hold-up has been that who would want that job? Who would want lower paid than you are elsewhere? Who would want more scrutiny than you get elsewhere? Who would want lower budgets than you get elsewhere? And how do you deal with the fact that the license fee is coming under increasing scrutiny? So you have to find a very particularly motivated candidate to be the sort of commercially minded person within the BBC. So from what I've seen, he's done good work. So he's already above targets of revenue, and he's set to hit 1.2 billion revenues by next year. So In terms of what he's looking at financially, that's what he's looking at. But still, he's not being paid as much as a Netflix executive of someone of his level. So that's why it's taken so long.
I mean, Karen, do you think they just kind of ran out of other people or other options, and he seemed a good chap, so they just went, oh, actually, you can have it after all?
Well, I mean, it feels that way, doesn't it? It's not ideal. Anytime you've been in an interim position for upwards of a year, you have to get the suspicion that your bosses are looking for someone other than you. So, hopefully that isn't going to taint his tenure in the post. But I think Alex has a really good point about it's a very challenging position. I think the BBC is in a very challenging position right now, as I think we might come on to talk about a little bit later, with the political environment being really challenging for the business. So it may be that they were hoping for someone with a little bit more almost like political savvy to be able to help them navigate and add value into BBC Studios that would help them navigate in that climate. But, you know, I wish him all the best. Good luck. He's got quite a job on his hands.
Maggie, does this come down to kind of CEO ego? Because obviously if you end up running BBC Studios, which is a plum job, big international operator now, doing more things in more countries, but you've got kind of Tim Davie above you. You never really get to own that space. Is that right?
Well, I mean, Tim Davie is stretched, greatly stretched at the moment. So I would have thought that you would have a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. Tim has spoken quite eloquently, actually, about the fact that he sometimes has to just go off and be quiet and have time to think. And he's got huge responsibilities. It's a very delicate time for the BBC. I personally am not actually too... the BBC is challenged, but remember, we're coming into the centenary celebrations next year, 2022, and I'm sure that they will come out with some fireworks. And I'm fundamentally against trend, thinking that the BBC is going to be diminished in importance, but still a very important institution for this country. And Tim is one of the good things about Tim is that he has actually been at the BBC a very long time, and he has, as we've been talking about, you know, has had a lot to do with the commercial side, but he's also an extremely clever person who understands almost every corner, I would say, of the BBC, from radio to international issues. So, but if they can get the politics right, I mean, he's made a lot of quite sensible things. You know, he's prevented the row over Jess Bromer, the person who was coming in to head up news. He's managed to sort of sidestep quite a bit of the issues, or current affairs rather, that there have been sort of potential, you know, elephant traps. I think he's managing pretty well, actually. But I would have thought Studios is since the person has been running it for a year and nothing terrible seems to have happened, then that's the marketplace. If the job isn't paying as much as you would be getting in the commercial center, that area, that's also the marketplace. And he's obviously decided to stay with the great public service broadcaster.
And in that way, I suppose, he does have a bit of an open goal, right? Because Britishness is one of the most marketable things at the minute. So, you know, between Bridgerton and Sherlock and Downton Abbey and, you know, even Idris Elba, right? That's some of the most sellable things in the world at the moment. And so if you think, you know, BBC, just make more Doctor Who, make more Strictly Come sellable formats, make more Top Gear, and, you know, they'll be fine. You know, Emma Raducanu winning US Open, it's a perfect example of just how sellable British content is at the moment.
Well, in fact, you know, at the Royal Television Society's biennial conference in September, which was sponsored actually by Facebook, one of the most key themes that I was watching all of it came out of it was, in fact, why are all these studios opening up in the UK? It's because there's huge respect for our centuries-old tradition of storytelling, for the kind of people that we have in Britain who are writing stories and fiction that can be turned into scripts, and to the general level of expertise that we have in depth, which has been built up for an awfully long time. And it was most heartening. I don't think that they were all almost singing from the same script. I'm simplifying it, but that is basically the theme that emerged from the top dogs of the streamers. So I think that you're absolutely right. The problem is, really, with things like Bridgerton, is that they have kind of almost dynamited the old tradition of costume drama, which we've come to love, the British version. And it's become obviously something else with Bridgerton, and so although it's very fashionable and it's saleable, the question for the BBC will be, how does it continue to do, if you like, traditional costume drama or literary based dramas, which still remain British, and is in a marketplace where millions of young, I mean, I think 84 million people have watched Bridgerton, millions of younger people are expecting something different from, it won't be just, you know, a prim Jane Austen kind of adaptation. That's the challenge for the BBC.
And of course, they've got to do it probably on a much slimmer budget than Netflix can afford as well. Public service broadcasters were in lots of discussion at Radio Days Europe this weekend just gone. So I was in Lisbon for that. It's the first time the conference has been back after 2 years of coronavirus-related pausings. I think this was their third rescheduled date. About half the number of people there normally, which I thought was a pretty good turnout, about 800 people. And obviously coronavirus came up as a topic a lot. And I think for radio had a pretty good coronavirus. And listening to both public broadcasters and commercial broadcasters speak, I think there was a real desire or a real understanding that they had sort of reconnected with their purpose, and the fact that a lot of listeners use it as a trusted news source, and radio scores very well as a trusted news source, that they altered their programming, they changed how things are broadcast a lot from people's homes. And kind of post-coronavirus, it almost sounded like that it's some special source which, when competing against new entrants, be they the Spotify's of this world or podcasters or different people, or Facebook with, you know, a lot of fake news trouble at the moment, that actually maybe it was one of radio's core brand values that they need to rediscover. Alex, I think you had a look at some of the videos that they were streaming from their website. I think Adam Bowie popped up from the BBC talking about some research that they'd done.
So their research was all about just how much, you know, radio and audio in general relies so much on the commute. Like, you go to work, you have it in your car, you have it on the tube or on the train or wherever. So they were interested in just what happened during the pandemic, expecting the commute, of course, to just vanish. And I think the first tricky thing was to say just how they couldn't do the Rajah figures. So they rely on going around to people's homes, which feels very old fashioned to me. But, you know, they go around and they get people to take notes and they chat to people in person. So those figures haven't been around for the last 18 months. They're just starting to come back now. But what research they've done showed that the morning spike was significantly less sharp. So there's fewer people going to work. But what the exciting thing was for him, at least, was that during the day more and more people were listening to audio. So in pre-COVID there were sort of spikes at lunchtime and spikes when people weren't meant to be working, but now with more people working from home, you're going to get people are sort of listening to music on their headphones or listening to radio on their headphones or podcasts or whatever. So they're actually quite excited about the fact that listening throughout the day has significantly increased.
Karen, has your audio consumption changed over coronavirus, and has it changed back as we kind of get out of it?
Yeah, I mean, I found the research also really, really interesting. My personal audio habits have changed in very much along the lines of what Alex was describing and what their research bears out, which is that instead of the 2 hours of kind of door to door commuting as a really concentrated set of activity, I'm finding opportunities to listen in across the piece. And I should say that this research actually bears out kind of Edelman's own, you know, we've been looking at changing behaviors and so forth. And it all makes sense along with what we're seeing. But we've also been looking and thinking about, it's not just when people interact with content, that when they consume a content to different parts of the day, they're looking for different things out of that content. So I think we should be thinking about what types of content better suit this new way of consuming audio. Our kind of data seems to suggest that when people listen in the morning, that morning commute is much more of a lean in type of thing. It's a daily catch up. It's what's happening. Whereas as they listen at other times of the day, it can be more subject matter focused. People are a little more interested in possibly having a deep dive. It's a little bit less of a news and catch up. And I think it'll be interesting to see if content producers, whether it be podcast or radio, start shifting to content that feels a little bit more spread across the day.
I think the data is fascinating. So we'll get first sight of Rajah's return on the 28th of October. And I was having a bit of a chat with some people, and there's been a little bit of a tweak to methodology, which I think they're going to be talking about quite soon. I'm sure we'll pick up on the podcast, which I'm sure everybody will find fascinating as much as I do. Newsletters now, and founder of Black Ballad, Toby Oradin, has raised over £300,000 from a mixture of equity crowdfunding and private investment. Karen, she spoke to Press Gazette this week. What was she saying?
So she was saying that that they were very excited to allow, the way she kind of put it was like almost allowing the community to support and back the business. It's an organization which is designed to, its aim is to tell the stories of Black British women, which I think is an underserved demographic in the media landscape. And I kind of got the impression that she was almost saying, okay, here's our chance for this community to put its money where its mouth is, really stand up and be counted. I do think that, you know, Black women, you know, in terms of the kind of overall minority ethnic demographic, Black women are not only underserved in the media environment, but also the pay gap for Black women is smaller than the pay gap for Black men. So there is money out there, and there is a consumer audience that's worth reaching out to. Even if you leave aside kind of diversity and inclusion, which I think should be considered, this is an audience that's hungry for the type of content that she's able to provide. And I would hope to see more of this kind of thing.
I mean, Alex, what she's doing isn't something massively different than we've seen kind of happening over the last 12 months, where people are really doubling down on communities of interest, particularly around newsletters, subscription media. What's your take on this? Are we going to reach a limit to the amount of Substacks you can subscribe to?
No, there are infinite demand, but it's, you know, the Substack stuff and the newsletter stuff is the latest pivot. So first we pivoted to social, then it was to video, then it was to search, then it was, we pivoted to podcast, and now all of the media is publishing to newsletters. And it's not a get rich scheme. It's not this magical silver bullet that's going to solve media's problems. You know, I have my own newsletter, Everything Popular is Wrong, subscribe now. And Ollie, when I set this up, you know, knowing what a full new media hipster I was, said it was a little bit retro and old-fashioned. It's not. It was ahead of the game. And, you know, take Newsweek's news, like, we now have 500,000 readers. We don't do that by, it's not this sort of thing that is going to be this magical thing. It requires a lot of work. So all of these Substack things about people setting them up and thinking they're going to make thousands of dollars very, very quickly, it's not the way it works. If you get 1,000 people willing to pay for your content, then great, wonderful. You have a really sustainable business model if you're one person doing this thing, but those models are rare, and it takes a very special talent to be able to convince 1,000 people to hand over their cash to you. And so there are so many infinite demands. Like, so there is either way of doing it, mainstream as I'm doing at Newsweek, or, you know, pick your niche. I don't think Black women's a niche. It's more a sector that's underrepresented. But what there is, I can think of five things that if someone offered me a really particular expertise on it, I would happily pay £5 a month for. And if everybody has five different things, there is so many different things that could be done. But most of those Substacks or newsletters will be set up and they either won't be kept weekly, or they won't be very interesting, or they just won't be very good.
I mean, reading Toby's story, I mean, she sort of felt there wasn't room for the journalism that she wanted to make, and so she set up Black Ballad to do that. Is this also a mainstream media problem, in that we're likely to lose specialists or people who can bring in new audiences to mass media if we don't look after them?
That's a data problem. So the analytics to show what is and what isn't popular. Mm. If you still go on page views, which is not the answer, nor ever was it, but it's still often taken as the answer, then you lose a lot of niche audiences, because you don't, you know, if 10,000 people read but stayed there for 2 minutes, is that worth more or is that worth less than 100,000 people being there for 30 seconds? Eventually, analytics will show that the 10,000 people were more valuable, both in lifetime value and audience memory and all of that sort of nerdy data stuff that I could talk forever about. Do not let me. If mainstream media doesn't understand that, if we don't get it, if we don't keep employing people who can find really engaged, if small, loyal audiences, then we're missing a trick, and then everyone will go to Substack and find the 5, 10, 15 things they want to read about, rather than just going to a news site. And it's how, you know, the buzzword we will be talking about instead of newsletters in a year will be appointments and habits, and all of that data will start coming in then.
Maggie, you're a specialist journalist, you're a media journalist, and obviously we talked about, you know, your special interest in Channel 4. Any plans to start a Substack, a newsletter? Do you think you could get a very high-paying premium audience to hear your thoughts?
Well, it would be so flattering, wouldn't it? Nobody's come to me to do one, so I suspect, really, I'm probably old news now. I'm obviously more bookish than new media. But I actually agree with Alex that the analytics are really interesting, as are the finances or the monetization of these quite specialist areas. It is the case, and he is right, that I can think of many areas in the media where the in-depth coverage is not what you would wish. And it's all about really recognising the fact that diversity is just expanding, whether it's the kind of music you like or even kind of the cosmetics you like. Let alone foreign policy and all of the heavy subjects as well. So that this is the world we're in now. And I'm quite in favour of it, to be honest. But I do think what you do need in the mainstream media is you do need very good specialists to be able to explain important stories in a way which the majority of the population, if they choose to, can understand, which is the other end of the splintering of interests. Otherwise, you don't really have a fully functioning society. So we have to have the in-depth stuff. We also have the broad stuff too.
And we'll be back with more media news, no login required, after this.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back. Maggie, Alex and Karen are still with me. Let's cover some more media news in brief. Let's start with the Conservative Party conference, where there was much tub-thumping about the role of the BBC and, of course, that Channel 4 consultation. Nadine Dorries, she's got straight into her culture, media, sport and digital job and has maybe surprised some of the TV sector with her views on Channel 4. Maggie, did they think they'd got away with it?
Well, I think that this actually plays totally into my book, because what actually happens is that you have a huge turnover of culture secretaries and they don't last very long. And they propose things, but they're not there, say, long enough to make sure that something happens. I didn't ever think that because John Whittingdale and Oliver Dowden had been removed from their posts, that it would be plain sailing for Channel 4. I mean, why would it be? They held a consultation. They got the results on the 12th of September. It was a very unsatisfactory kind of three-month process over a summer holiday with a desired outcome. And involved in that was Andrew Griffiths, the Conservative MP who had, of course, been the chief executive officer of Sky. So they were all poised to go down this line of not allowing the status quo to continue. So I didn't expect her to back down. But I do think that she's the fifth culture secretary since 2015. So I kind of think he was bound to say that. Whether it will result in a big change, I don't know. But what I do think is happening is that Channel 4 is rolling out its regional and nations policy really fast, and that is making it very difficult for any party that is trying to woo out-of-London audiences, not just the Red Wall. And it's also quite clear, too, that Channel 4 will still have an important role to play, it seems to me, in our creative economy, whatever happens. So, no, I'm not surprised. She was bound to say that because she wants a result of sorts. She's not there for the status quo. None of them are. It doesn't mean they're going to dismantle. And I would have thought now, you talked about Facebook, but will it really look play well if, you know, I don't like the fact particularly that Channel 4 keeps buying popular programming like The Great British Bake Off, but God, the audience loves it. It put in very crude public interest terms, why are you going to annoy millions of people by messing up some of their favourite programmes, whether you love them yourself? For example, too, the Paralympics came out just at the point when they were changing over culture secretaries. Channel 4 had a rather magnificent Paralympics this year.
Well, let's just pick up on that. So they'd played a bit of a blinder leading up to the consultation, Emma Raducanu coverage on Paralympics, on all those sorts of things, nations and regions. But Karen, they've had a bit of trouble recently, or their suppliers, Red Bee, have, which had a massive fire, which has basically knocked out all the subtitles on Channel 4 for over 3 weeks now. People aren't happy, are they?
No, they are not. And so they're still not getting subtitling and full accessibility across a number of very popular Channel 4 shows. And what we saw coming out this week was the host of The Last Leg, Adam Hills. He was calling them out on that specifically on his program, which I thought was a very good intervention on his part, because he knows his audience and what he's trying to reach, but also was pretty extraordinary to have him on a live show effectively openly critiquing his employer. It was a pretty bold move, which I expect will have gone down very well with his audience, and probably not so much with the Channel 4 execs themselves. So really interesting, stroppy presentation from him.
Well, you know, when you get to Gogglebox, they do allow criticism of Channel 4 programs on it. So I mean, the real problem is actually the fact that so much of the broadcast contracts have all been concentrated with Red Bee. Channel used to actually broadcast itself from its own headquarters. And I do think that this is exposing one of the vulnerabilities, if you like, of outsourcing, as we've seen in other industries.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it does expose the vulnerability of outsourcing, but also it shows where your priorities are. Because if accessibility were considered to be genuinely business critical, they would have solved it long before this, I suspect. Sorry, go ahead, Alex.
No, I was just going to say, Alex, I mean, the Channel 4 press on this, normally they seem pretty good at responding to these issues. They've been a bit trapped, I guess, because they can't control getting it fixed and getting subs back on the air.
Yeah, what do you say? Sorry, we messed up, but it's kind of out of our control. There is no way of PRing this well at all. So, you know, the more they talk about it, the more they realise that there is no way to apologise effectively for it. And they could be, not saying they are, they could be hedging the fact that it's still a small percentage of their audience that are directly affected by this. And that's not a good thing, is it? But like, by keeping quiet about it, it's still that small minority of audiences who are going to be directly affected by it.
There's a tweet from Ofcom today. So they say, we've received around 500 complaints about Channel 4's ongoing outage. C4 has assured us it will shortly communicate to its audiences the clear measures it's taking to restore these services. They also say that Channel 5 has now restored these services to its forward schedule and is adding them back to recent on-demand programs where they are lacking. We welcome this progress and will continue to engage with broadcasters to make sure these services are restored as a priority. It's about 3 million people that use subtitles, you know, varying levels of hearing loss. It is a big issue, but I think also what's interesting, BBC basically had their own backups. Channel 4, not so much. Channel 5, less channels. But even, like, I think one of the 4 music channels has only basically just gone back on air properly. So there's clearly a list of things they're trying to get through to get this stuff back on air. Podcast company Audio Boom is getting into the originals business with the launch of Audio Boom Studios. Karen, they've mostly been for sales. They look after hits like No Such Thing as a Fish. Why do you think they're getting more into content, particularly in the UK and Europe?
I think to some extent it's just a natural expansion strategy. As you say, they have a good roster of content they've got from others, but as any business, as it grows, I think wants to be more in control of its own fate. Also gives them a greater profitability ultimately, because they can share where they go with it next. So I think from that point of view, it makes sense. I do think this is a increasingly competitive space, so I don't think it's necessarily a given that just because they put the resources behind it, they can get a breakaway hit. So there are risks associated with it, but I always like to see people creating new original content rather than just re-syndicating other content. So I, you know, good luck to them, and I hope they do make a success of it. As I say, they've got a pretty good eye in the past for hits that they can discover. So hopefully they can apply that to their original commissioning.
And I think they've had quite a lot of US success with originals. So it'd be really interesting to see they take that knowledge and understanding and apply it to other markets. So all of that brings us to the media quiz. This week, it's entitled Casting Call. So three analog services have recently announced digital spin-offs. I'm going to give you the talent they've announced, and you tell me what's been commissioned. Okay, three rounds. Buzz in with your name if you know the answer. So Alex will say...
Alex.
Karen will say...
Karen.
And Maggie will say...
Maggie, who's been in Italy for the
show. Show off. Let's play Casting Call. Cue music. Right, number one. So I'll give you the talent. Tell me the media that's been created. Number one, ex-Pop World presenter Makita Oliver and journalist Grant Tucker.
Alex. Sunday Times thing, video series thing, and it's going to be Makita Oliver and Grant Tucker doing some sort of like talk TV thing.
Yes, so this is Sunday Times culture magazine show for YouTube, but no doubt will appear on talk TV, whatever talk TV appears. 1 point to you. Number two, star of MTV's Catfish, Julie Adjuanga.
Karen? Is it a GMB spin-off, YouTube-only, YouTube special, Off the Table? Is that the one?
Yes, that's right, Off the Table, spin-off from the Good Morning Britain team, which aims to debate some of the most important issues affecting young people today. And it's going to live on YouTube. I mean, Alex, interesting couple of YouTube shows there. Yeah, the pivot to video happened a long time ago, but people seem to think there's still some dosh in it.
I was pitching morning breakfast shows for the BBC that appeared on YouTube only 11 years ago. We're going to get there eventually. This still isn't it. It's still seen as a bonus. Or, you know, like listen to a longer, less well-edited interview across podcasts. Like, it's not the idea. Give people better content. Don't give people less good content. It's an interesting foray into it. But compared to GMB's main revenues, YouTube is not that, unless they end up getting millions and millions of views every episode. So interesting to see how financially it makes sense for them.
I did wonder, though, if it links to the conversation we were having earlier about people's changing listening habits. And I think their changing viewing habits is probably also shifting in this post-COVID landscape. So it might not be that breakfast telly is appointment viewing anymore. And maybe you consume that content over your day. Maybe that's the play they're making here. Could be interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they both do. Right, final one. It's an obscure one. If you saw the notes we sent you, you might have an idea. Finally, voiceover artist Vicky Blight.
Karen,
yes.
It's some sort of ad campaign about older people teaching them how to use digital radio. Is that it?
Yes, it's the latest campaign from Digital Radio UK, and it's aimed particularly at the over 60s to help them understand how to get DAB and DAB Plus services. Maggie, is there a digital divide that's stronger with older audiences, or have they got more time to actually understand what's going on?
I mean, what's wrong with it? If you feel you need to have some kind of gentle education program, go ahead with it if it increases your audiences. This is all about making demystifying.
So congratulations to Karen. You are our quiz winner.
Woo-hoo!
Well done. That's our show for today. My thanks to Maggie Brown, Karen Robinson and Alex Hudson. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not bung us the price of a flat white from Soho House? Just head to themediapodcast.com/donate. And of course, follow us to hear new episodes when they drop on your podcast app of choice. If you haven't got one of those, just tap in podfollow.com/themediapodcast into a browser and it will drop you into an app. My name is Matt Deegan. You can find my weekly newsletter about the audio industry and more at mattdeegan.com. The producers of the media podcast were Matt Hill and Pete Price. It was a Rethink Audio and PPM production. We'll see you in a fortnight.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.